Hi, this is Kelly Jones, and you're listening to the Run to the Top podcast.
Hello, everyone. This is Coach Claire Bartholik, the Planted Runner, and thank you for joining me on the Run to the Top podcast brought to you by Runners Connect. I hope everyone is staying healthy out there and taking some time to reflect on what really matters in life. I'm really excited to bring you my conversation with Kelly Jones today. Kelly is a board-certified specialist in sports dietetics, focusing on performance nutrition for endurance sports. She has worked with nearly all types of athletes and has consulted for high-level organizations such as USA Swimming, the Philadelphia Phillies, and the New York Roadrunners. She is also regularly featured as an expert in publications such as Runner's World, U.S. News and World Report, Women's Running, and Women's Health. Kelly started her career as an associate professor of nutrition for 9 years in Pennsylvania, and before that, she was a Division I athlete in swimming. Today, as a mom and a business owner, she continues to compete in road races and triathlons and creates recipes and resources that offer practical solutions to optimize physical and mental performance. Kelly uses an evidence-based nutrition approach, focusing on what she calls plant-forward performance nutrition, which, of course, I love. We pack a lot into this 30-minute episode, and this is definitely one that I wish we had a full hour or even two to really get into everything, but I'll just have to have Kelly back another time to talk about all the things we couldn't quite fit into this episode. So at the end, if you have any questions that you'd like me to ask her next time, be sure to send me an email at Claire, C-L-A-I-R-E, at runnersconnect.net and let me know. And before we get into all things nutrition with Kelly, I want to thank all the listeners that have taken the time to give us a review on iTunes. It really makes a difference. And now, here's my conversation with Kelly Jones. Hi, Kelly. Welcome to the Run to the Top. Thanks for being here.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
You specialize in performance nutrition for endurance sports. Can you explain exactly what that means and how you work with athletes?
Sure. In terms of endurance sports, we're looking at running, obviously, as well as cycling, triathlons. I do work with a variety of teams that are doing more high-intensity intermittent sports, which I tend to group with endurance training because of the training that they're doing with practice. So things like soccer and field hockey and even swimming in terms of their training too. So when you're looking at performance nutrition for those populations and how I work with athletes, I already mentioned working with groups. So a lot of speaking, curating, travel plans for teams that might be traveling together. And then when we're looking at the one-on-ones, it's a little bit more individualized approaches to how to enhance someone's diet and nutrient intake in a way that it fits with their lifestyle, right? So even if someone's, running and their neighbor's running, that doesn't necessarily mean that they need to eat the same exact thing and be eating at the same exact times and whatnot. So really working on tailoring their diet to meet their performance needs.
Okay. Well, everybody wants to know, what is the best diet? Is there such a thing?
Of course, that's the number one question, right, for anyone working in the nutrition field. And I don't believe, and I don't think any dietitian that you ask would believe that there is one best diet for everyone. And no one wants to hear that, right? Everyone wants the, this is what to do, here's your quick fix. But there's, one pattern that I tend to recommend a little bit more often, which is plant forward, which we may get to talking about a little bit more later, but that's regardless of, what diet that might be prescribed to you if you have a certain medical condition, because sometimes that can vary a little bit. Maybe you need to alter your fiber intake or be a little bit more mindful of sugar or even cholesterol, things like that. But for anyone, I still would recommend inclusion of more plants, no matter what you're trying to follow. And this kind of goes back to decades of research that continue to suggest that the Mediterranean eating pattern is really the best overall diet for everyone. And that maps to not only things like physical performance, but also mental health and longevity, which I think from a health perspective is probably the best information that we could have when we look at what eating patterns are associated with longer lifespans. That's kind of the ultimate in my eyes. So I'm always thinking about those principles of the Mediterranean diet and how to better incorporate them into different people's diets and lifestyles.
Yeah, you have so much in there that I want to touch on.
Yeah.
Eating for performance can sometimes be different than eating for longevity. I mean, especially with endurance athletes, runners, we tend to eat a lot of sugar, you know, in training. Can you talk about some of the push and pull there with that?
For sure. And I think that the difference too is that might be best for longevity for an endurance runner, right? Or an endurance athlete, because their body requires different nutrients, to be able to perform at that level. So if you were trying to compete in an endurance sport and not fuel during your runs or not put in the carbohydrates that your body is going to thrive from while you're training, that could actually be detrimental to your health. So you have to think of the context of these recommendations for what you're doing with your body. A lot of the recommendations that we're seeing in the news and that research is being done on are for the general population, who tends to be in the United States more sedentary and definitely, you know, not running marathons or half marathons or even exercising, you know, the recommended 5 times a week, 30 minutes a day. So, you know, when we're looking at longevity, we have to think about those recommendations for that population and then pull back and say, okay, well, what about your life and what activity you're doing? And then again, all of those other lifestyle habits too, like the activity level for your job and any of the other demands that your life gives to you.
Sure. So, I mean, yeah, it's pretty clear that as an endurance runner, let's say somebody training for a marathon, you know, can handle a lot more sugar. But we still get quite a few questions at Runners Connect about, I want to just eat whole foods. And are there whole foods that I can have during training or during races or during runs that aren't quite so much sugar? How do you feel about that?
So I, you know, based on the research, and this is something else where just like the Mediterranean lifestyle, we have decades of research showing the value of carbohydrates for optimal performance. So could you still train and race with less carbohydrates than what might be recommended? Sure, but are you going to feel as energized physically and mentally as you should? Are you going to perform as well? That's the question. And that may be a little bit individualized too, but still for the vast majority of people, we find through repetitive research that ingesting those carbohydrates during exercise is beneficial. From the carbs as sugar standpoint, sugar during a race is what your body is going to use most efficiently for fuel without having the potential for giving you gastrointestinal distress. Having said that, there are definitely some other whole food options that people can gravitate towards. I'm a big advocate for honey, even though it's still sugar. Honey is a whole food sugar source that's not, you know, refined in any way. And research actually shows that it's similar to sports gels in how it can enhance performance and training. And there's actually some cool new research too on potatoes. So yeah. Believe it or not, people are taking potatoes that they've mashed up, just the potato, not adding butter or anything like that, and putting them in little pouches and taking them for runs too. So there are a variety of different ways that you can incorporate those carbohydrates or sugars without relying on the refined carbohydrate products. But your body's still ultimately going to do the same thing with all of that. And it's going to deliver it to your muscles so that you can use it as a quick and efficient energy source and maintain your blood sugar so that you're not crashing physically and mentally and then maybe craving immense amounts of sugar or carbs later because you didn't have them when your body really needed them.
Yeah, let's go dive a little deeper into the whole macro thing. So macros being fat, carbohydrates, and protein. Is there a certain percentage that you tend to recommend, or do you usually give a macro-based plan to people who come to you?
I tend not to give macro-based plans because I find that for the majority of people, that's not very sustainable to be weighing your food all day long every day. You know, when a stressful situation hits or something messes with your normal lifestyle, people then who've come to rely on that can tend to panic and feel like, okay, well, now what do I do? And what do I eat? And I might as well just go completely off the rails because I can't be counting every gram, right? And I just like for people to think about the time and physical energy that that takes every day too. There's so many things on our to-do list all the time and so many things we can be doing to enhance our diets and lifestyles that putting the physical and mental energy there can take away from some of those other things that we could be focusing on. Having said that, what I educate more on is how to build a balanced plate, how to build balanced pre-workout and post-workout snacks, what balance of snacks is more appropriate at different times of the day or different training periods. And when people can learn how to put those things together, their diet tends to fall within the recommended macronutrient ranges, which is somewhere between 45 to 65% of energy from carbs. If you're more physically active, you should be a little bit more on the higher end of that. And that's going to be, again, for runners, kind of goal ranges in the higher ends, because they should be fueling a little bit more with carbohydrates before and during exercise, especially. Fats, we know the best recommended range is 20 to 35% of energy. And then protein is a little bit more broad, because it's basically what's left over from the carbs and fat percentages. 10 to 35 is the recommended, but what I tend to find usually is best for people is somewhere between 15 and 25% of energy. But what really matters, if you're only looking at, you know, it as a percentage and you're not eating enough total calories, let's say, you're still going to be underfueled for your workouts. You might not be getting enough protein for the repair and recovery processes that you need, plus all the other things protein does for your body. So again, I try to think a little bit more about what should your plates look like and how do we build those nutrients in that way. The other issue that I tend to find with macro-based plans is there's not the emphasis on nutrient timing and nutrient quality. So in terms of timing, that's huge for runners and any athletes or active individuals, is when are you getting these nutrients in? You know, you can hit your quote macro goals that you find from a free program online at the end of the day, but if you ate most of your protein in two separate instances versus spread it out throughout all your meals and snacks, you're probably not repairing and recovering as well as you can, for example.
Okay. Well, let's talk about nutrient timing. When should you eat what?
Right. So I'm a big advocate for eating your energy before you need to use it, right? So starting earlier in the day. What I tend to find with a lot of people, especially if they're trying to count or restrict things, is that at the end of the day, they get to that point where they're feeling a little bit more of an uncontrollable sense of hunger. They're eating a ton at dinner and then a really big nighttime snack. And really, we want to try to break that cycle by saying, okay, I might not be hungry in the morning because I ate so much last night, but let me start my day off with something. I tend to get some pushback from runners who wake up and want to just like run out the door, right? And not have anything beforehand. And if it's an easy run for you, especially less than an hour, might not be a big deal. But for most people, I would still say have a half a banana or a couple of dried dates or, you know, even that shot of honey or a goo. And if you're relying on some of those things before, you probably set your body up a little bit better for a well-fueled run and then better appetite control the rest of the day. So putting in that energy early helps you to feel like, okay, I've got something to work from. And then you're not that overly hungry that people get, and you can make reasonable decisions about what you're going to eat next. I then recommend, you know, a balanced breakfast. And depending on how many miles people are logging, maybe a snack between breakfast and lunch, maybe not. I try to help people learn to have their hunger levels guide them a little bit. So even for two people, again, who might be the same height and weight and gender and age, and, you know, logging the same amount of miles, maybe one of them is having a morning snack and one of them isn't. It might depend a little bit more on their physiology, other parts of their lifestyle too. Balance lunch. And then again, if you're doing an afternoon or evening workout, pre-workout snack. Don't try to make it from lunch until after you exercise to have dinner, let's say. Sometimes depending on timing, I'm advocating for splitting your dinner into two, right? So that you can have that pre and post exercise snack or meal that's going to fuel you well for your training and help you recover well too. So there's a lot of trial and error in finding what is going to work best for you, but it really is important to make sure that you're fueling enough before you're going to be running and then putting in the nutrients within a certain period of time afterwards as well.
Okay. So that means probably you're not a big fan of the glycogen depleted runs.
Not so much. And, you know, the glycogen depleted runs, while there's a lot of people talking about them, there isn't a lot of research to support them. And what I try to help people understand too is that you might see there's one study on something, but that doesn't mean that the practice is what we call evidence-based. So evidence-based practice is when you're looking at multiple studies done on multiple populations that we've seen repeated evidence that shows the same results. And that's what we make our recommendations based on. So obviously we need some people to play around with that to have the new data, and new data can be promising. But until we have repeated research showing that that's actually beneficial for performance in the long term, it's not something I'm going to advocate for.
Okay, good, because I hate them.
Yeah.
And I don't tend to recommend them to people either. So
right, and they're miserable, right? So I try to tell people too, if you have a run where you're not feeling energized, where it's mentally hard to get through, it's physically hard to get through, how is that going to help you get closer to your goal, right? Versus going out and feeling well-fueled and having the energy and the intensity that you need, that's going to be what helps your muscles adapt so that they can perform better in the long term.
Okay, good. I'd love to touch on race weight. You've definitely seen some disordered eating in the athletic population, and I would love to hear about your experience with race weight, performance, endurance, orthorexia, that whole bag of worms.
Right. Yeah. So there, a whole bag of worms. There's lots of different moving parts there. So in terms of race weight itself, I try to advocate that people are not hyper-focused on weight for race day, because like some of the other things I've mentioned, it takes the attention away from some of the practices that you might want to implement that are going to make you feel energized for your runs or recover well from them too. And I think something that a lot of people don't consider with race weight theories is that a lot of the most elite athletes and a lot of people who are winning these races and are performing so well, they have genetic predispositions to maybe both their weight that they have when they're racing or when they're not racing, and genetic advantages in terms of just their physiology and the muscle fibers they have and how well they adapt to training. So just because, you know, someone is performing super well at a certain weight doesn't mean that you will too, because maybe genetically your body needs to carry a little bit of extra weight to be healthy, for example, and to, again, feel energized for those runs too. So to, you know, put a number on paper and say you should reach this, especially if it's a weight that you haven't been at or you haven't been at since high school, have, you know, 45-year-old women like, well, I weighed this when I was 18, so that's what I want to work towards. And that's not really realistic, right, at different stages of life for a lot of people. The other thing is that we don't really have good evidence that a smaller body size is actually going to benefit racing, but we do have a lot of evidence. You mentioned orthorexia. Something else I'll bring up is relative energy deficiency in sport. We do have a lot of evidence that a smaller body size can actually impair your health in the short and long term and may impair performance more in the long term. So what we tend to see sometimes is that if people start to diet or restrict their energy intake or overexercise, their body weight may go down and their body may respond in a mild stress response where it releases these endorphins. And that can maybe in the beginning correlate with the feeling of being able to perform better. But then as time goes on, your body feels a little bit more depleted and it gets into this, you know, stage where it starts to metabolically adapt, and not in a good way, where it wants to kind of hold on to the energy that you have. It can slow down body processes that involve hormone production and impact your bone health in negative ways. It can impact reproductive function, which I know is, you know, people are getting older, they might not care as much about, but, you know, any of those hormone inconsistencies are not good long-term for your health. And I think that poor mental health is one of the areas that is most important to consider if you're trying to work towards a specific race weight or training weight. When you're not mentally healthy, it's really hard to have any other areas of your health work well too. And that includes physical health, but also can affect your relationships, your productivity with work, and other things on your plate. So you want to try to have a holistic approach when looking at the goals that you have with running and how is that going to affect other important things in your life.
Yeah, I think that's a really tough balance to find with runners, especially, you know, marathon or ultra distances, because really training for a marathon by nature is over exercising. It's way more, you know, exercise than we really need for good health. And it's not why we do it. So how do you find the balance between, okay, I want to eat food for fuel, but I don't want to eat too much. I want to eat the exact amount. And I'm a type A runner, so I want everything to be absolutely perfect. Like, how do you find that balance?
Right. And it's hard to find that balance for any athlete. And I think especially marathon runners, even people who are trying to accomplish half marathons, you're doing that because you're a goal-oriented person, likely. And you like to know what it feels like to push the boundaries a little bit, right? So when it comes to food, though, I think that, you know, finding the perfect diet, it's really important to understand that that doesn't exist really. And that we are not in a place now, even though it might be marketed here and there, we're not in a place where we can look at the map of your genes and say, this is exactly what you're supposed to eat. We may get there someday, but that information really doesn't exist right now. And, you know, it does require some trial and error, but again, a little bit of flexibility in your diet too, so that you can still enjoy other parts of your life. So I try to encourage people to think about, well, you know, you might be trying to work towards racing optimally, but what about living the rest of your life in an optimal way too? How do we do all of those things or more of those things? And we can do that by being a little bit more flexible with our eating and, you know, including some foods that we enjoy along with mostly the foods that are going to nourish us and make us perform better too.
Okay. So this is a perfect segue into the plant forward approach. So what do you mean plant forward nutrition approach? Does that mean that everybody has to go whole foods plant-based or tell me a little bit more about that?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. The reason that I go with plant forward is because I think that there's a lot of confusion about the term plant-based. Plant-based really means based in plants. It does not have to be vegan. For some people, it does mean vegan or excluding all animal products. But plant-based really means that you're basing your diet in whole plant foods. When people see, again, whole foods plant-based, that can a lot of times, again, mean vegan, but can also include things like fish or eggs and maybe even a little bit of beef or pork or something like that. And I want to try to have an approach that feels inclusive to people. I don't want people to feel like it's this way or the highway or it's all or nothing, and then make it feel like it's impossible to reach any nutrition goals, right? So you might have someone who has been eating tons of meat their whole life, or they're eating a lot of ultra processed foods, and that can seem so impossible for them to get to the point where they're eating a plant-based or whole foods plant-based diet. So I love to work with people to transition them just to understand that the more plants you include, the better, right? And we can take baby steps, or if you have the personality where you want to go a little bit faster with it, then that can be fine too, as long as along the way, you're doing it in a way that you're not going to end up with nutrient deficiencies. So I hope that explains it a little bit better.
Yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit about nutrient deficiencies and what are the challenges of plant-based eating for performance?
Yeah, I find a lot of times when someone does go all or nothing with it, I wind up seeing them, they reach out to do one-on-one counseling because they found, oh my gosh, now I'm feeling depleted, or I went and got blood work done and my iron's low, or, you know, my mental energy is off. And a lot of times when you do it so quickly, you wind up just, you know, cutting out meat and you don't replace it with something else. I know even for myself, when I started eating, you know, more plant-based and had a period where I was eating vegan, I didn't even eat tofu at that point because I was like, tofu is weird. I don't eat tofu, you know? And then started to realize, oh, actually, this is pretty good. Oh, it tasted weird because I didn't know how to cook it. And, yes. You know, so you need people to understand that when you cut something out, you need to replace that with something. You just can't go, okay, I'm not eating chicken and I ate it every day before and there's nothing else there to replace that. So protein can be an issue if people are not mindful, but it shouldn't be an issue if you're including the right foods and the right quantity and variety of foods too. I find more often it's protein quality and protein timing that can be a problem. So in terms of protein quality, it's getting all of the essential amino acids or the building blocks of protein that we have to be eating every day. You know, if you're having plant milks, for example, instead of dairy milk, if you're not choosing soy, then there's a really good chance that you could be having meals where you're getting no protein, right? Or 5 grams. Let's say that you used to make your oatmeal with dairy milk and now you're making it with almond milk and that has 1 gram of protein in it, then that's not really an equal trade-off, right? So if you're not going to choose soy milk, where else can you build protein into that meal? Nuts, seeds, where are we going to find that, right? Also with dining out, I find that sometimes people then get into this mindset of, well, if it's vegan, then it's healthy. But if you're choosing, you know, a meal at a restaurant that's vegan, maybe it's super rich in, you know, carbohydrates and fat, but really low in protein and fiber. So how can you learn what foods to build in there that are going to give you that balanced meal that you need?
Right. Or like an Impossible Burger, right, which is almost as bad as a regular burger.
Right. In terms of nutrients, an Impossible Burger has almost the same amount of saturated fat as a beef burger. So, right. Like, why are you making these decisions? Is it, you know, I really want to treat myself and do it in a more environmentally conscious way, then, you know, that's where an Impossible Burger might fit in here and there, but not really going to be, quote, healthier.
So how do you teach people to trust their body when it comes to eating? Like, I know you said earlier, you know, you talked about some athletes who like to go out for a run first thing in the morning because they don't feel hungry. So you tell them to eat anyway.
Yeah.
Against what they're feeling. Mm-hmm. But then after, they are supposed to trust what they're feeling. So it gets kind of confusing.
That certainly gets confusing. And it especially is for athletes. So I definitely specialize in trying to merge the evidence on performance nutrition with the philosophies of intuitive eating. And even intuitive eating itself is confusing because you might think, well, all I want to do is eat a sleeve of Oreos. And it's really not what your body wants. We're just so out of tune with what our body wants and needs. Because we've had years, really, I mean, if you think about it, since you started eating as a baby or toddler, people have been telling you, okay, it's time to eat. Here's what you're being offered. Then you get to school and maybe you're hungry, but you have to wait until, you know, the scheduled lunchtime to eat. So you're pushing past that hunger. Then maybe you've gone on a diet or something else is just, you know, taking you away from what your body is telling you intuitively, like, I'm hungry now, I need food now, or this is what I should be eating. So even getting back to that intuition does take some work. And I really like to explain that to people. It takes work to eat intuitively, but then it's never something that you have to do again in the future, right? So I find a lot of times people go on a diet and they're like, okay, well, I gained all the weight back or this happened, so let me go back on that diet. That's the benefit here is you put the work in and then you can listen to your body. And when it comes to things like, okay, I know you're not hungry now, but have the race fuel before your run or have the, you know, blocks or the honey during your run, even though you're not physically hungry, or have a smoothie afterwards because you're dealing with post-exercise appetite suppression. In those times, you might not feel hungry, but the more that you implement those practices, the more it becomes intuitive for you because you realize if I go out for that run without having something before, I'm not going to feel as energized, right? Or if I go out and try to do a half marathon and I don't take in enough fuel, I'm going to, you know, bonk at mile 10. So it becomes intuitive once you implement some of those practices because you don't want to compromise how your body should feel later on.
Yeah. And I think sometimes your body actually does adjust when you keep doing it over and over again. And if you kind of tell yourself you need that post-workout fuel, eventually your body will actually come to crave it. Do you find that?
I do. I think the post-workout fuel might be a little bit more challenging because intense exercise really can suppress hunger hormones. But again, I think that it builds into, well, if I have that post-workout, like even if it is a glass of milk or soy milk or a smoothie right now, then I'm not going to be absolutely starving 2 hours later, right? So I start to recognize that I'll have better eating patterns later in the day, and that makes me feel better, right? But again, before and during, for sure, your body begins, you know, this process of craving it and wanting it because it knows that it's what it needs.
Yeah, I definitely feel appetite suppression after a run, but like after a swim, I don't know whether it's the cold water, but like something about swimming, I'm
for
absolutely
everyone.
Starving.
It's not just you. I was a swimmer. I swam in college and I was actually at the University of Connecticut and they actually were doing research at the time and there's not been consistent results, but on why it is that swimmers are always more hungry and tend to, you know, carry a little bit more weight because of than a runner might, even with similar, you know, hours logged of training with cardio activity. It has to do with the water temperature. So it might be a water temperature thing for sure, but
yeah,
we're still out.
Well, we're getting into the home stretch here. So I am going to ask you a few questions that I ask everyone. So you were a swimmer, not a runner. Is that right?
I was. And then when I finished swimming, it's just so much work to get into a pool. So I did transition to running after college. Yeah.
Okay, good. Well, if you could go back and talk to yourself when you started running or swimming, either one, what advice would you give yourself?
I'll definitely go to running because swimming was way too long ago. With running, I did not listen to my body well enough and I was not flexible with training programs. And I really wish that when I signed up for my first half marathon, I had gotten a running coach because I didn't really know what I was doing. And I found some plan online and I stuck to it and I ended up, you know, probably injured during it, but didn't really admit that until after the race. And now I've had like nagging knee pain, you know, for 10 years. So it's something where I think that a lot of athletes and type A personalities just like to push through and they're like, this is what the plan says, I'm going to do it. And I wish I was more flexible with that and listened to my body and backed off a little bit too.
Yeah. Yeah. That's definitely, I hear that one a lot. What is the greatest gift that running has given you?
I think that running allows me to stay connected in a variety of different ways. So it helps me stay connected to myself because most of the time I like to run alone. So it's some of that me time. I also absolutely hate the treadmill. So it helps me stay connected to nature too at different times of the year. And that really helps to ground me. And it also connects me with other people because I like signing up for races with other people, whether it's family or friends. So I really do like that community feel.
Awesome. Awesome. And where can listeners connect with you if they have nutrition questions or where can they find you?
Yeah, so you can head to my website, kellyjonesnutrition.com, where I have recipes and tips and information, but you can also get my contact information there. And then you can also follow on Facebook or Instagram. On Facebook, it's Kelly Jones Nutrition. On Instagram, it's Kelly Jones RD.
Perfect. Well, we'll have all of that listed in our show notes so that people can reach out if they have more questions. Well, thank you so much, Kelly. We have crammed a lot of information into a few short minutes. I think we could have gone on for a couple more episodes, so I might just have to have you back.
I'd love that. It was fun being here.
And so we could talk more, but thank you for coming on and have a great day.
Thanks for having me. Take care.
Wow. Kelly is so full of knowledge on sports nutrition, and her passion really comes out when she talks about it. I love how non-judgmental she is about simply trying to incorporate more plants into your diet instead of having an all or nothing approach. It would be so simple if we could just say, everyone eat X, but don't eat Y. But that's just not how it works. Everyone's bodies work a little differently and everyone's goals are a little different. So of course, everyone's diets are going to be a little different and that's okay. I also loved what she had to say about race weight. I know I certainly tried to get as tiny as possible when I was focused on my marathon goals, and I found out firsthand that not only did that approach not work, but my performance was actually better with a few more pounds and a lot less pressure. Thankfully, I didn't do any long-term damage to my body, but we need more experts talking about the dangers of the race weight mentality. So I'm glad to have more knowledgeable people like Kelly debunking the race weight myth. And that's it for the Run to the Top for today. Join me again next week and have a great run today.
Thanks for listening to the Run to the Top podcast from runnersconnect.net.